141. We have gotten to the year 1540. This is some, 33 years, or 23 years, removed from what we're celebrating next weekend. Next weekend, we're celebrating the 1517 beginning of the Reformation with the nailing of the 95 Theses. And we've made it up to 1540. And with all that history, those 33 years in mind, let's get out our football challenge and see how much we remember to this point. Everyone have this in front of them or able to see it? You can put a score in the left-hand column. If you don't know what a safety is worth of the rest, we'll tell you. So Martin Luther was born on blank in 1483, November 9, 10, 11, or 12. Circle your answer, please, or have it in mind. Has everyone circled their answer? Or put your finger, and don't move your finger. How many said November? No, I'll give you the right answer. You won't embarrass anyone. The correct answer is November 10th. So if you got it, you received a safety, which is worth 2 points. Why did Luther's parents name him Martin? A, his father's name was Martin. B, Martin was a very popular name. C, he was baptized on St. Martin's Day. Or D, his mother always liked that name. Everyone got an answer? The correct answer is C. Very often the name was given on the saint's feast on which a person was baptized. Next, Martin's parents hoped that he'd grow up to be A, a miner like his father, B, a monk who would pray for them, C, a doctor who would provide care for them, or D, a lawyer who would take care of them. Everyone pick an answer. Lock in your answer.
D as in
Demacario. That he would be a lawyer to take care of them. A touchdown is worth 6 points. Next one. When Martin attended school, most of his classes were taught in A, Latin, the language of the church, B, German, the language of the day, C, Greek, the New Testament language, or D, English, the universal language. A, Latin. If you go to the Missouri Synod Visitor's Office in Wittenberg, it's located right next to St. Mary's, the city church in Wittenberg, and it is the old Latin school. An extra point is worth an extra point. One. Next, when caught in a terrible thunderstorm, Luther prayed to A, St. Anne, the patron saint of miners, B, Jesus, his loving Savior, C, St. Martin, his family's patron saint, or D, Mary, the mother of Jesus. Everyone locked in on an answer? The answer is A, St. Anne. Anyone know anything else about St. Anne? Patron saint of miners. Any other facts about him, about her?
Was she Mary's mother?
She's the mother of Mary, right. No, she's the one that did the Immaculate Conception. Mary was immaculately conceived in St. Anne, according to Catholic dogma. I don't know what their Catma says. That's worth a safety. That's worth two. Next, when Luther entered the monastery, which order of monks did he join? Aloysius, A. Aloysius, A. However you pronounce it, A. B. St. Augustine, or Octoliber Augustine, C, St. Ambrose, or D, St. Athanasius. Everyone got an answer? B is correct. He was an Augustinian monk. After graduating from college, Luther became a professor at the University of Erfurt, University of Mansfeld, University of Rome, University of Wittenberg. Everyone lock in your answer. And the answer is D, Wittenberg. Touchdown is worth 6. Finally, who comforted Luther by telling him of God's love, not his judgment? Was it A, Stefan, B, Staupitz, C, Stephanopoulos? I think he's a commentator. Or D, Studenrauch. Stubenrauch. The answer is, you got it? B, Staupitz. Has everyone gotten every answer right so far?
No.
Okay. Next one. Who came to Germany selling indulgences? Jeremiah Townsend. B. James Taylor. Sweet baby James. C. Johannes Trautmann. Or D. John Tetzel. Tetzel the pretzel salesman, right. D, Tetzel. Who excommunicated Luther from the Roman Catholic Church? Was it Pope Leo IX, Pope Leo X, Pope Leo XI, or Pope Leo XII? Judy, lock in your answer.
I
did. I heard it. Judy got it right. Pope Leo X, B. X marks the spot. That's a field goal worth 3. What did Luther do with the bull of excommunication? A, he buried it. B, he hid it so that no one could find it. C, he refused to receive it. Or D, he burned it outside the city. Lock in your answer. Everyone got it? The correct answer is D. He burned it at the Elster Gate. And for the quadruple jeopardy question, what does Elster mean? The Elster Gate. It's not the Watergate. And Elster is a mockingbird. That's worth 6 points. The next one. Where did Luther make his famous statement, "Here I stand"? A, Diet of Worms. B, by the church doors in Wittenberg. C, on the holy stairs of Rome. Or D, at the monastery in Erfurt. Lock in your answers, please. Everyone got an answer? The correct answer is A, at the Diet of Worms. Extra point is worth an extra point. That's 1. 4th quarter, faithful unto death. Sudden death, overtime. What book did Luther publish to help teach children the Christian faith? A, a primer of Bible stories. B, a catechism of questions and answers. C, a dictionary of Christian terms. Or D, a manual for Sunday school teachers. B, I hope you all got that, the catechism, right. And Luther says of everything he wrote, the 2 things that he would preserve to posterity are his translation of the Bible and the catechism. Next one. The safety is worth 2 again. In which city did Luther die? Was it A, Eisenach, B, Eisleben, C, Erfurt, or D, Erhard? I think Amelia was buried there. Everyone got an answer? Lock in your answer. Everyone got it? The answer is B, Eisleben. Eisenach is not far away. Eisleben is where he was born and where he died. That was worth a field goal. 3. What was the name of Luther's wife? A, Margaret, B, Anna, or Anna, C, Sophia, or D, Catherine? Oh, come on, you all said the answer. I guess that means you all know it. D is Kitty My Rib, the book that he wrote. Kitty My Rib, Catherine. Extra point. How many children did Luther have? A, 3, B, 5, C, 6, D, 8. Lock in your answer. The correct answer is C, 6. 3 boys and 3 girls. We won't add up the points because I'm not good at adding, so I don't expect you to do it. Tally up how many you got wrong.
I'm not as dumb as I was.
How many got 0 wrong? Well, we're human. How many got 1 or 2 wrong? I'd say that's a pretty good score. How about 3 or 4 wrong? That's pretty good. 5 and 6? 7 or 8? 9 or 10? That's okay. The facts are all out there. If you're worried about what you get wrong, go back to the Luther biography and you may find the answers there. We're all learning. Let's go to page 141 in our handout. We are on the first full paragraph on the right-hand column on page 141. I think Mike Fodor is going to relate to this first paragraph. 1540, all right, around this time, this most worthy Luther had been visited by God with many sorts of physical maladies and afflictions, which is why he constantly had death on his mind and called upon God for a blessed time of death. So we have already said that there were many times where I know Mr. Fodor in the last couple weeks and I over the years have had kidney stones, and we know that Luther was afflicted by that. He had many health frailties that are sometimes attributed to the rugged life that he lived in the monastery, where he didn't sleep much, that he might stay up all night, where he beat his body with whips, and when he did not eat well. And so the monk's life had sort of tainted him for life, but it all reminded him of death. Now, is death something that is an enemy of God's people? Yeah, it constantly hounds us, so presently it acts as a foe and an adversary to us. But whose death do we know it is? Who does death belong to? Who has tamed it and made it his own? Jesus. And so as opposed to being a curse that would drive his people away from God so that this life of sorrow would lead to a life of ultimate misery and regret, death has been tamed by God as a pathway to life, because the Prince of Life, Jesus, went through life unto resurrection. And so, what is a Christian's attitude towards death? Yeah, we anticipate death. In the Lord's Prayer, if you look in Luther's famous catechism in the in the seventh petition, deliver us from evil, what are we praying to God when we say to him, deliver us from evil? Yeah, for a blessed death. Because ultimately we are delivered from evil when we die. When we're delivered into heaven, the devil can no longer war against our souls. The world, by its threats and its promises, do not tempt our souls any longer. And when we go to heaven, we are sealed in our bliss. And there's no way that the devil can take us away from God. And so death is a blessed day. On the day of our death is our last sinful day. And the day when we look forward to rising again in the resurrection, to eternal life that is no longer struggling with sin, but living only to the glory of God and in love with our brothers and sisters in the house of God. And so if we are beleaguered in this world and we seek rest, we love to put our head on our pillow and sleep. The older I get, the more release I find in peaceful sleep, away from the distresses of the day. But all of that for Christians, as we commend our souls to Jesus when we fall asleep, is sort of a practice for death, that we will fall asleep and leave all of our troubles behind and all of our pains. And in the time of suffering, maybe we look forward to death a little more. And I look at the struggles that older people have that make the struggles when we were younger seem rather trivial. And we can see the grace of God living in them, that they rely on God in their sufferings and look forward to deliverance through death. Yes?
St. Paul summed it up, the Apostle Paul summed it up the best when he said, to die is to gain.
To live is to Christ, to live is Christ, and to die is gain. And that's in Philippians 2, Philippians 1 and 2, where he's saying that he doesn't know whether he prefer to go to heaven and be with Christ. And he said, I prefer that. And yet for your sake, he says, I prefer to stay so that I can minister to you the gospel and build you up in your faith. So thank you, Tony. For St. Paul, to live is Christ, whether here or in heaven. And living for Christ here is sharing the gospel with others and sharing his love with his people. And to die is gain. Because here we only have Christ by faith and we don't see him, but in heaven we will see him and we will have in hand what our faith held in blindness. Luther was also thereby severely hindered in his work and was forced several times to vacate his pulpit before the end of his sermon. Often he could not start reading a letter without having to stop two or three times. But despite this, he published several glorious writings. Besides the beautiful commentary on the Songs of the Exalted Choir, Psalm 120 through 135, he published two sermons on the baptism of Christ and of the Christian based on Matthew 3, which he preached in Dessau at the baptism of a prince. He issued a very serious admonition to the pastors to preach forcibly against usury, which he was convinced was already so prevalent that he didn't dare hope for things to improve. What's usury? Interest, right. What did Luther have against charging interest on loans? How so? Right, and whether you're using that money to buy seeds for your land, and there's a drought, and the money does not pay out, you still owe it to me back, plus interest. And so who was able to lend their money? The rich. And who had to pay it back? The poor. I wonder what Luther would think of the Church Extension Fund in our day. Hopefully in Church Extension Fund they show some mercy, that if a congregation can't pay it back, they forgive the debt. And Luther said that's how it ought to be between Christians. If you lend someone money for a good purpose, you ought to think of it as a gift. And if they're unable to pay you, if they're able to pay you back, they absolutely should. But if they're unable to pay you back, you ought to consider it as a Christian gift. And that's sort of how we ought to think of our charity. We should think of giving to others as a gift and not expect to get something back for it. Yes.
And then.
And I think that's a good observation as a fruit of usury, a bad fruit of usury. That's true. But Luther's bottom line on it, the central reason that he's against it, is that Charging interest is a guaranteed outcome, and it's impossible to guarantee any outcome. When you lend, you guarantee you're going to get it back with interest. And in life, there are no such guarantees. Yeah, I think Luther would have been much more charitable to the capitalistic idea of investing. So if you invest in an enterprise that you think is worthwhile, and they lose, they don't. You also lose, right? So you're truly invested. And if they do well, then you gain with them for a favor that you did. I think Luther would be much more in tune with stock market. And I'm not talking about day traders and speculators. That's just those again are just they want money without working for it. And yeah, yeah. But to truly invest in someone means that you share their risk. And their success is your success, and their failure is your failure. Tim?
Yeah, what I've read on Luther, I've heard this argument before about the usury and the LCF and what have you. But I think what he points to, as you talked about, is usury amongst Christians, one to another. And back then, they didn't have these institutions, so it perpetuated the sin of greed amongst those who lent to those who didn't. But now we have institutions that are established for that reason and are helpful to the community. It wasn't that way during Luther's time. And that's what he speaks to.
Well, maybe we've read different things, because I've read where it did seem like these institutions were at least beginning to form. Because he would talk about widows having nothing, you know, no hope of future income, that would see that as an enticement to invest and have some secured outcome. And he said, for the widows in your congregation, you know, be merciful and cut them some slack, because it's out there, and they see that as their only hope, so have some mercy with them. But he was so adamant with this that when bankers were Christians in the congregations, he told the preachers to excommunicate them. So again, I agree with you that there were not prominent institutions in those days, but like a lot of stuff that's around today, it was just starting to come around in that way in those days. Yeah.
I might be mistaken about this, but I seem to recall that there was an Old Testament law that when the Jews lent to each other, they were not to charge interest.
Right. I mean, there was a whole system of the Jubilee year when you had to pawn your land because you had gone broke, that you got the land back every 50th year. So, yeah, that's very much Old Testament-like. Let's move on. Enough on usury. I have some money to lend you, but all right. Luther also published that excellent exposition of the 90th Psalm, which was so improved from the original publication that one does well to distinguish between the two. And so when we quote Luther on the 90th Psalm, you'd want to say his later commentary on Psalm 90. In the year 1542, Luther installed Nicholas Amsdorf, whom the elector had chosen as the Lutheran bishop in Naumburg and Zeitz, to this holy office, and consummated his public installation by preaching a sermon in which he gave the paradigm for the consecration of a true Lutheran bishop, that he would further expand in a written book that would appear under the same title a short time later. Now, I love this because it talks about Luther's broad association with the church. He was not an ivory tower scholastic or educator who stood afar off, but he was in the church and involved in the life of the church. He helped to write agendas or service orders for the church. He preached at official times like this installation of a bishop. And his life in the church, his interaction with the church, spawned his writings so that his theology was not abstract or distant, but applicable to the congregation and the life of the church. And that's an important thing. Theology is not just an academic exercise. It must apply to the church and the life of his people. Paradigm is a pattern or an order. So, for instance, in Lutheranism, we have the paradigm of law and gospel. First, we apply the law to make a person uncomfortable with their sin, and then we apply the gospel, which is the relief that every sinner has in Christ. And so we have a paradigm of law and gospel, a pattern. Any other questions? In this year, the Bohemian Brethren, as related by their bishop Comenius, sent two representatives to Luther for the fourth and final time in order to hear in retrospect what results they might expect from the purification of the church. Who are the Bohemian Brethren? Have we taken them on yet?
They make good beer.
How do you know that? Not from Austria. They're from Bohemia. No.
They are followers of John Hus.
Yeah, Prague. So Czechoslovakia, Eastern European is where the Bohemians are. And Prague is where John Hus had his ministry. We remember that Hus died a martyr at the hands of the papacy about 100 years before Luther. And did we deal with the Bohemian Brethren before in this class? I know we've talked about it before, but Hus was popular, and his prince backed him, and the Bohemian Brethren are basically Hussites who clung to the Orthodox faith under Hus's teaching all these 100 years before the Reformation. And so he called them Bohemian Brethren because he considered he and Hus as being brothers, taking on the same illegitimate authority of the papacy. And these people had lingered without the service of professional clergy by people that they raised up on their own because they were apart from the Catholic Church for this whole 100 years. And if we wonder, you know, did God preserve a true church before Luther and the Reformation? The answer is yes. But they were in these little pockets. In southern France, there was a group called Lugdunners that held on to the Orthodox faith. But he preserved them in small clumps. And the Bohemian Brethren were some of these. And so the Bohemian Brethren sent emissaries to Luther, and they tried to get together. And Luther was very patient. They couldn't see eye to eye with every element of the doctrine of the ministry. They had unorthodox practices, like communing infants. And so there were some schisms, some differences between them. But Luther was always very patient with them, because they seemed amenable to learning and to hear from Scripture what the truth was. So the Bohemian Brethren sent an emissary in 1840, after 1840. After they had spent 2 weeks in cordial conversation with him and the other theologians, at their parting, Luther invited them to be his guests any time, extended his hand to them in the presence of the professors present, and said, "You are the apostles to the Bohemians, as we desire to be apostles to the Germans. Carry on the work of Christ amongst you, as you also are granted opportunity, and we will also carry it forth as it is granted among us." And so, although there was some schism in practice between them, he recognized them as brothers. Now, is Luther here appropriating to himself and to the leaders in Bohemia the office of apostle? Is he claiming to be an apostle? Then why does he say it?
Because apostle can mean ambassador or just a sent one.
Apostle can mean sent one, right? But what's their relationship, the sent ones, after the time of the apostles? And the apostles are taken to heaven in their martyrdom or their deaths. who takes their place? The pastors, right? And that's where you're coming from. The sent ones, those who are called to be the public proclaimers of the word, they are not apostles, but they hold the apostolic office. They are commissioned, just like the apostles, to go forth and preach and teach all things that Christ has appointed the original apostles. Does that give the apostolic office, the pastoral office in our day, the right to teach new revelations?
The apostolic office has never had the right.
No. No new revelations, but what was revealed to the original apostles. That's the deposit of doctrine that gets handed on from generation to generation. In this year, the Bohemian Brethren, as related by their... Oh, no, I'm sorry. You are the apostles. But Luther always uses that term, work of the Lord, such that he, above all, provide the church with pure doctrine, whereby the legitimate faith will be planted and nourished as a good tree, which, with that, also constantly not only shows how such a good tree of itself will bring forth good fruits in a pious life, but also through her writings and constitution, as the circumstances demand, instituting a fine, honest, external church order for all that is good, as witnessed in all Lutheran church orders from the age of Reformation during her entire existence. We've gotten a few paragraphs, and our time has vacated. So we will no doubt meet upstairs for Bible class next week, because we'll be all set up for a banquet down here. So look forward to seeing you next week. God bless your week.